It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. In an attitude of prayer, we give thanks on this beautiful day for the beauty that is all around us and within us. For the beauty of the earth, we give thanks and we accept its stewardship. For the love of family and friends, love we did not earn, we give thanks and we vow to be worthy of it. For the love that lives in our own hearts, we give thanks. We hope and pray that we can nourish that love until we are filled to overflowing and the world around us is fed with the overflow. We are stewards of love and life that come through us more than they come from us. And only by sharing these gifts can they or we grow to full size. And so we give thanks for the many gifts of life. And now it is also our turn. Let us share the gifts of life with ourselves, with others, and with the often hungry and lonely world around us. Let us share our gifts. Amen. 3 weeks ago, I began talking about liberal religion, a liberal style of being religion that's very distinctive in every religion in the world, and that can be dated back to more than 2,500 years ago. This is a much broader sense of liberal religion than you're probably used to hearing about, so let me take a couple of paragraphs to explain it. Between about 2200 and 2800 years ago, in what one scholar named the Axial Age, religious thought all over the world turned on its axis. Before that, religions had been religions of fear, centered on offering bribes to the gods for our safety, trying to see the whole world as somehow revolving around our wishes, if only we could find the right sacrifice, the right bribe, the right ritual, the right costume, the right priest, the right religion. It was like a million fearful people in search of a persuasive magician, and many magicians came forth to be persuasive. Ancient religions, both East and West, had human sacrifice. And the purpose of human sacrifice was that it was the highest thing we could think of killing to give to a god. You find echoes of this in ancient Judaism, just as you find it in all religions. In the Old Testament, you find the story of Abraham and Isaac, and here's an echo of the time when kings were sacrificed, and then kings got smarter, and they said, "Wait a minute, I'm the king. I got a son. Take him." And in the Abraham-Isaac story, you're now seeing the echoes of the end of that practice, where they moved finally from human sacrifice to substituting animals. No one asked the ram about this. They just took him. There are a lot of ways to sketch this history, and many books have been written on it, so it's something that you could sketch very long or fairly short. And I want to do it fairly short, in about three or four sermons. So I'll take an approach that might feel simple if you've done a lot of reading in this area, but I'm betting most of you have better things to do with your time. Right. Last time, I talked about how the messages of the emerging liberal religions can be found both with and without supernatural stories. Both with and without gods. The stories and the gods are optional. not necessary. Hinduism taught reincarnation as a central belief, and then in their most important Upanishad, you read this amazing statement, there is no consciousness after death. You're recycled. Your parts become the parts of other things. Nothing is destroyed, but your consciousness, your memories, and your identity die when you die. That's a fairly bold message in the history of religion, 2,500 years ago. It's a message, and this is true in every religion, it's a message that the prophets proclaim and the priests suppress. The religion of the prophets and the religion of the priests has always been wildly different. Liberal religion is the religion of the prophets, not the religion of the priests. Now, Buddhism also taught about reincarnation, but in the more advanced Buddhism, what they really taught about was simply waking up, and waking up by outgrowing the need for our illusions, including the comforting illusions. You talk about a stark religious message, that's one. Taoism and Confucianism from China did religion completely without gods. Talked about the way things are, the way life is, how to be in harmony with it. And Confucius was concerned with the kind of magic in interpersonal relationships that makes societies smooth and life-giving. No gods, no stories. So the best teachings of religion can be done with or without the stories, with or without the gods. It sounds odd to say in religion that the gods are optional, but they are. And nobody taught us this better than the ancient Greeks. I want to talk about the Greeks today because they introduced some very new things into Western religious thinking. You may not think of the Greek thought or the Greek philosophy as having a lot to do with religion, especially Christianity. It had absolutely everything to do with it. Without the Greek thought, Christianity would not have grown in the form that it grew. It has absolutely everything to do with it. The Greek concern, going all the way back to Homer, was with here and now. How do we live? How do we live wisely and well? They had both teachings and stories. But the gods in the Greek stories are unlike the gods of any other religion I know of. The gods were quite clearly projections of natural forces and psychological forces. They're projections and imaginative pictures and stories about things that are in life and in us, not some supernatural critter, even though they pictured them as Zeus and the rest of the gang. Gods like Zeus and Poseidon, they decided, were responsible for thunderstorms or storms at sea, but they were also responsible for the storms in our souls. The idea of pursuing someone for years with an anger and a fury and a vengeance that will not let go of you is the story of someone under the grasp of Poseidon or the Furies. They made them gods because they're eternal parts of the human condition. So to understand their gods is to understand ourselves writ more completely. Very different approach to religion. Very powerful approach to religion. Originally, the Greeks had 6 male and 6 female deities. A lot of people don't know that. And they were simply aspects of the human experience writ large. I read a book on the gods of Greece by Arianna Huffington several years ago, and a good book. She grew up in a Greek culture in France. And so she grew up with the gods and goddesses of ancient Greece absolutely alive as part of her life. She said that's how she structured her psyche. It's how she understood herself. Now here's a woman who's a single parent of 2 daughters, who's also an immensely bright, focused, driven woman. She was the youngest president of the debating team at Oxford in the school's history. And she said that she has understood her whole adult life as being the conflict between and the need to make some kind of peace between the incessant demands of Demeter, the mother, for her duties to her daughter are absolutely sacred for her, and Artemis, the powerful, focused, driven, brilliant woman that brooks no dissent from anyone. You think about it, those two goddesses really don't go together well. But that's not the goddess's problems. That's her problem, how to put them together. But what looking at life this way does is show that these two powerful commands that she feels in life are sacred commands. They're eternal and sacred commands that she must learn to grow around and incorporate. Now, that's a sense of religion and a style of religion that lends dignity to the believers because the gods are part of them. Powerful stuff. The Greeks did sacrifices. There's always the supernatural level of religion. The Greeks did sacrifices to their gods, especially Apollo and Athena, but it was more like trying to bring those facets of life into sharper focus. When Muslims say in the Quran that Allah is closer to them than their jugular vein, every Greek could have said this. Where is Demeter and Artemis in the life of an Ariana Huffington? It's in her heart. It's closer to her than her jugular vein. But the other development of Greece is the one I really want to talk about. Very different. And this started before Plato, though Plato really brought it to a head. The Greeks were the first people who believed that we create noble humans according to how we fashion them, what models we use to shape them by. They thought breeding mattered. They don't think we start as blank slates. Breeding matters, but it isn't the whole story. And no matter how good the breeding, you have to shape it. You have to fashion it. And the question then is, with what will you shape it? With what will you fashion it? Now think about this with me, and you'll see how powerful the Greek logic is. And they said, well, it's clear that what you have to fashion it by are the highest, noblest ideals that you can possibly articulate. And that means that this collection of the highest ideals of a culture is the most sacred treasure of the entire culture. Without it, we can't even hope to fashion noble people. And that also means that that collection, they had a word for it, that collection of the highest ideals of culture is the most sacred duty of everyone in the culture. Owners, workers, the whole gang, everyone in the culture, your most sacred duty is to know, to uphold, and to pass on this collection of the noble ideals without which we have not got a shot at making the noblest kind of people. Now, there's a culture aspiring to something so high, it's really breathtaking. They had a word for this collection of high ideals. It's a word you may well never have heard of in your life, at least not in Greek, but it's a word that you know quite well from another language. So this is your word for the day. This is Vocabulary Builder for October 16th. The Greek word, collective noun for these ideals, was paideia, P-A-I-D-E-I-A. You may never have heard of it. It was in the root of their word for both child and education. And that's really the whole story. This is what you have to use to educate children to turn them into the kind of people we want. It's still in our anglicized versions of the Greek words and the roots for our pediatrics and pedagogy. It's the same root. It's hard to imagine how powerful the lure of this paideia culture, as it's been called, was. I want to tell you one story about it. It's one of my favorite stories. It came from the comic playwright Aristophanes. Now, they had several tragic playwrights, and they had a bunch of comic playwrights too, but Aristophanes is the only one whose comedies have come down to us, so he's the best they had by default. They also thought he was great. And if you've read Aristophanes' comedies, you've got to admit, the humor in these things is like 14-year-old bathroom humor. But the plays, bathroom humor and all, were about very serious things. Some scholars have said that Aristophanes is the one who can be blamed for the trial and death of Socrates, and that's probably true. that it was Aristophanes' play The Clouds that presented Socrates as the most dangerous person in Athens because he made the youth question the Paideia. Powerful stuff. So this scene involves Aristophanes. It involves him, and it involves a young comic playwright. Now, when the Greeks had their Olympian games and Pythian games and all the other games they had, they gave medals not only for athletic excellence, but also for artistic and poetic excellence. So you could get a gold medal in playwriting at the Olympian Games. And this young man had just won the gold medal for the best comedy at the Games. Now, you'd think old Aristophanes would be congratulating him, but he wasn't. He was cheering him up one side and down the other. And the gist of what he said to him was this: you just went for the cheap laughs. That's all you went for. You never at any moment upheld or transmitted the Paideia. That was your only sacred mission. And you failed. And compared with the failure in that sacred mission, all the gold medals on earth are not worth a straw. Now that's high aspiration. And if that doesn't sound religious, it should. It's a profoundly religious message that more than anything else we must uphold and try to embody and for God's sakes pass on. The highest ideals we know how to articulate, that's how we form ourselves, that's how we form our children. If you don't think that's a religious message, you're wrong. They don't get more religious than that. It's just a religious message done without the stories and without the gods, except for the stories the playwrights wrote and Plato wrote. That old story of Aristophanes, that we are commanded to serve only the highest ideals, has been an inspiration to me in my own work ever since I read it over 20 years ago. But even with that story, you've probably never heard of the word paideia and are not sure where you need it, and are pretty doubtful that it's going to catch on. But you do know the word in Latin. A few centuries later, Cicero read all this stuff about the Greeks, and he read about the Paideia culture, and the idea blew him away, and he realized they don't have a word and they don't have a concept like this in Latin, and they absolutely need one, because the Greeks were right. That collection of the highest ideals is what we use to make noble people, and without it, we don't have civilization. So Cicero coined a word to translate this into Latin. And the word he coined was humanitas. And the word means the essence of what it means to be most fully human. It's a pretty perfect translation. And that word has been the core for 2,000 years and more of all the humanities education in Western civilization, and of all the liberal arts education in Western civilization. These are the classes we've taught to try to teach ourselves how to become human. You may learn how to make a living from an accounting course, but unless you can also understand the messages of the plays and the poetry and the great literature, you'll have a harder time making a life out of it. And that's what the Greek philosophers were really about. They weren't trying to inform their students as much as they were trying to form them. This was a way of life. Even though the different philosophers disagreed, they all agreed on that. It's about how to live. After Socrates, you have a transformation in Greek philosophy because it's no longer about whether you know the right things. After Socrates, philosophy isn't about knowing the right facts. After Socrates, it's much more personal and much more uncomfortable. That's why they killed him. After Socrates, the question is whether you're the right kind of person. Do you have a right to talk about things this high if you haven't lived this way? That's Socrates. That's pure religion. Pure, deep religion. Socrates' experience on some people, his effect on them was unbelievable. I want to read you just one. It sounds like it was an altar call, almost. It was a rich playboy
named Alcibiades who met Socrates, and Socrates changed his life in ways that just tore Alcibiades apart. Plato wrote about it. He knew him. Here's what Alcibiades said. "I was in such a state that it didn't seem possible to live while behaving as I was behaving. Socrates forced me to admit to myself that I don't take care for myself." That's religion. That's liberal religion. You find that concern in every liberal religion in the world. You just don't usually find it said that powerfully. Now, you may think, this is all fine, but Greek philosophy, even if it was about a way of living, and even though it had all these high ideals and the rest of the stuff, certainly doesn't have anything to do with any religion you know, and it certainly doesn't have anything to do with Christianity. You'd be wrong. It's a fascinating transition from Greek philosophy without stories and gods to Christianity with stories and gods. It happened quickly and easily, and it's even easy to trace it in history. It's an amazing transformation. You could say that it happened through one concept and one word. The concept was the notion that philosophy is about living right, about how to live. The word means love of wisdom, but the wisdom, the Sophia that they loved, wasn't facts. It was the wisdom to live by. How to live wisely and well is what Greek philosophers were about. Early Christians thought that what they were doing in the second and third centuries, when they're trying to figure out what this new religion is that they're inventing and putting together, and they're deciding, wait, this is what we're about too. We're trying to teach how to live wisely and well. That's what religion is about. So that idea gave them a way to talk to the Greek philosophers. And then they found one word that let them convince themselves, and a lot of people since then, that they had a superior philosophy to the Greeks. You can read St. Augustine in the early 5th century, and Augustine looks at Christianity as a philosophy. Nietzsche once said that Christianity was Platonism for the masses. Augustine would have agreed. He thought that what Plato was about was what Christianity was about. Christianity just had an edge and could do it better. And that's because of this one magical word. A Greek philosopher named Heraclitus talked about the Logos. L-O-G-O-S, the Logos. It's an almost untranslatable Greek word. And he said, this is the structure, the understanding of everything, of reality, of life, of everything. And it's this Logos that we need to feel and understand. That's how we know where the center is. That's our tuning fork that we can tune up on. It's the Logos. And we have that word in so many of our words. Right? Psychology is the Logos of the psyche, of the soul. Goodness. Sociology, anthropology, the understanding of humans, the whole thing. We want to understand that structure, that Logos. It's religious. Well, the Christians loved that word. And they said, you know, you're right. And now we recognize how and why our own religion is so superior to your Greek philosophies. Because we have the ultimate Logos. You have a Logos that came down as an idea. We have a Logos that came down as a man. I want to read you four lines you may have heard before, although I'll bet you've always heard them mistranslated, but I'll give you the correct translation today. We're not supposed to reveal secrets, but we do. And they're the four lines that show that translation from Greek philosophy, secular Greek philosophy, to Christianity as the ultimate philosophy. It's just brilliant. And it happened almost this smoothly in the history of religious thought. They're the first four lines from the Gospel of John. You've heard them mistranslated. You've heard it as, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Right? This stuff. No. The Word was Logos. Not Word. Now let me read it to you the way it was meant. And you'll see the whole translation from Greek philosophy to Christianity in four lines. It's amazing. In the beginning was the Logos. And the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, and without Him not one thing came into being. What has come into being in Him was life, and the life was the light of all people. It's that quick to go from the profound teachings of secular Greek philosophy without stories or gods to some of the most profound teachings of the liberal spirit of Christianity. It's that quick. It's amazing. Just a few sentences. What's this like when this happens? It feels like the Holy Spirit moving through time, granting life and favor on those it touches, but wearing different costumes, wearing the costume of the age and the culture and the era where it lands. Sometimes it dresses up in gods. Sometimes it dresses up in wild myth. Sometimes it just dresses up in plain, deep, confrontive, hard, philosophical talk about who you are, who you should be, and how you should live. It's the same spirit. That's the spirit of liberal religion. Next time, I'll talk about the liberal religious spirit in Christianity. It's the one we don't hear much about. But you don't get off easy in this, you know. We're in dangerous territory here. We're talking about how we should live, who we should be, and this isn't a sterile list of objective facts. Nobody gets off the hook. It's the living spirit of liberal religion and of life, and it looks at you because that's its job. And it looks at you and it asks, what about you? Are you living as you should? Are you taking proper care for yourself? These aren't just mind games, you know. There are lives at stake, and one of them is yours. So you, what about you?